The Church at Ross Bridge is a bridge to belonging, believing, and becoming in Jesus Christ. We hope you enjoyed this message and visit our website at rossbridge.church.
Good morning, church. One of Jesus' most repeated teachings on prayer is one that I think is overlooked much of the time. Over and over again, in a variety of ways, Jesus teaches that we should dream big and request big answers to prayer. When is the last time that you prayed a prayer that was shamelessly audacious? We're on a 40-day prayer journey as a church. We're doing 5 Sundays in the series, weekly small group studies. And in this series, we're either kind of beginning a prayer life personally for the first time, new construction, or maybe we're renovating our prayer lives by taking some things out, adding some new things in. It's based on the work of Dr. Mark Batterson in his book, The Circle Maker, which draws upon the first century BC story, Talmudic story, of Honi the Circle Maker. Honi was a devout Jewish leader, and there was a time of drought in Israel, and the people were desperate. They were asking that God would bring rain, and so they go to Honi and they say, "Would you please pray that God would end this drought, that God would bring rain for our harvest?" And so Honi responds. He steps outside into that dry dust and draws a circle with his staff and steps inside of it and says, "Lord, Creator of heaven and earth, you have the power over the land and the skies and the seas. You can send rain, and we need you to send rain. We are desperate, and we're trusting you to send rain." And the rain finally comes. And the people for generations look to him as an expression or example of an audacious prayer, asking God that God would intervene, would change something in the world by stepping out on faith. We began last week by recognizing Jesus' first instructions to prayer are not what you should say, but where you should go, the manner in which you pray. He teaches his apprentices before what they should pray, how, and even where. He says, "Go into a prayer closet, close the door so you won't be distracted, and then your Father is going to see you. You will have clear eyes to see your Father, and you can present your requests." And what we ended up doing was challenging everyone to draw a circle, literally a circle. We gave out 10-foot sections of rope in which you could sit on the floor somewhere in your home and have a circle. And inside that circle, we were encouraging everyone to go through a linear progression of prayer. It begins with the ACTS acronym. Words of adoration, recognizing God's attributes, God's goodness, God's mercy, the provision that God gives us all. The second is confession. Are there things in our lives we have done or failed to do, and we need to name them to become transparent before God? The third is thanksgiving, making a list of things past, present, and even future that God provides for us. And the last is where our circle really gets specific. We offer our prayers of supplications. This is telling God what you need. And we said that it begins first with you, one thing to change in you, then one thing to change in your household or in your close relationships, and finally one thing in your world. I made an additional graphic to just kind of capture that visually. Begin with you. That's the first thing you pray for, change in you. The second is someone you care about or some relationship in your household. And then the third, of course, is your world. And that could be defined as your neighborhood, your church family, something in the broader world. We're trying to practice these kinds of prayers. And our goal is to have a two-emphasis kind of prayer. Effective prayer always has these two components or emphasis: seeking the will of God and seeking the glory of God. If we're missing either one of those, it's not the kind of prayer that Jesus teaches you and me to pray. So today, I'd like to focus on what it might look like to seek the will of God and the glory of God by looking at one of Jesus' teachings regarding shameless audacity. In the book of Luke, there's this parable, a wonderful little parable I would like to paraphrase for you. It's 1 a.m. You are sound asleep. Your children are asleep. Your dog is asleep. All is quiet until you hear at your front door someone banging on the front door, someone's finger repeatedly hitting the Ring doorbell, someone making their way around to your bedroom window and knocking on the glass. And you wake up and you're startled and you're disoriented and trying to figure out what's happening. You pick up your phone and look at your Ring notification, and there is one of your closest friends, their face 2 inches from the glass, pointing and saying, "Let me in," trying to get your attention. They seem desperate. And so you throw on your robe and you shuffle your way to the front door, and there they are. And they're saying, open the door, and they're tapping their watch, you got to hurry. And you open it up and they say, look, I'm sorry to disturb you, but I've just had a guest that I wasn't expecting. And you know that hospitality here in the South is much like it was in the ancient Near East. We are required to provide them with food, to set a banquet before them, and I don't have any food. I need your help. I need bread, I need milk, or whatever else we collect during Snowmageddon, and I need it now. Jesus says in that moment, you'll give them what they need, not because you're their friend. You're frankly quite annoyed at what they've done. They have disturbed your entire house. You chastise them for waking up your kids, but you recognize they would not be making an appeal this urgently in the middle of the night, this drastically, if they didn't really need it. So you don't direct them to the no gas station or the 24-hour Walmart. You go into your pantry, you get what they are asking for, and you present it to them. Jesus then says in chapter 11, verses 9 and 10, so I say to you, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And the one who knocks, the door will be opened. That's Jesus' teaching. But there's a beautiful example that's found in both Matthew and Luke of this actually happening. Someone praying a prayer with shameless audacity. And I'd like to look at their example and story with you today. Here's Capernaum. This is on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee. These are the ruins of the first century community there. That's where Jesus, having grown up in Nazareth, which is about 37 miles to the southwest, goes and kind of, we believe he even bought or built a home there. And most of his Galilean ministry for the first 3 years of his ministry on earth takes place in or around the Sea of Galilee. And this is kind of his home base. Now, Jesus, and what we're going to look at, has just completed the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. At the beginning of chapter 8, he's coming down off the mountain back into his hometown when all of a sudden, he's approached by a centurion. This would have struck great anxiety in the heart of any first century Jew. You don't want to be approached by a centurion. You don't want to have them stand in your way and to hold court with you as the subject. These are scary people. He represents not only the foreign occupying military force, but the commander of that force. I mean, imagine if you went home today from church and you've been filled with the Spirit of the Lord, you've been in God's house, you're feeling really good, and you turn down your street and there they are, a dozen law enforcement vehicles, maybe an ambulance and a fire truck. And there they are standing in your driveway, and it's not just law enforcement, but the chief of police waiting on you. You're going to be greatly concerned. You turn to your spouse and say, what did you steal? Or you think somebody in your family's hurt or something has gone wrong. Is our house on fire? It strikes fear in your heart. It would have been no different for Jesus, and I would think absolutely worse because they represent much more than just local law enforcement. But that's not the nature of this. It's not a confrontation, it's a request. And so it says at the end of verse 5, the centurion asking for help. And I would invite you to read the next part with me. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly. Now, maybe that statement would have also caught Jesus off guard. There's not a problem that's being corrected in the Jewish life in Capernaum. It's a request from one of the Romans. Jesus asks what I think is kind of an interesting question. Verse 7, Jesus said to him, shall I come and heal him? Now, you can hear in the request or the statement in verse 6, there's an implied request for help. But Jesus, almost as though Jesus is saying, I want you to tell me very specifically what it is that you're asking for me to do. What's the outcome that you're hoping to have, and how do you think that I'm going to be able to help you reach that outcome? Verse 8, the centurion responds. The centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. And that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. Jesus, in verse 10, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him, truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now that's a stark warning. Jesus, having heard the response of the man who is the centurion, turns to his own followers and says, this is your example. I haven't seen faith like that in any of you. In fact, you will be surprised one day in the eternal kingdom of my Father when you see people who are not just Israelites coming and sitting at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in fact, some of you who see that your citizenship is only a matter of political or racial or cultural identity, rather than having true faith, will find yourselves on the outside of my Father's kingdom. Then Jesus turns back to the centurion. Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that moment. This is a painting of this interaction between Jesus and the centurion from a 16th century Spanish painter. Jesus is there in the left-hand part of the image, and as you can see, he had somewhere to go. And he's being stopped, and he's having to turn and now give his attention to someone else. And there before him is a Roman commander. All the Jews are living as a subjugated people at this time. And here, this Roman, who is a commander, the one who's in charge of all of Capernaum, is kneeling before Jesus. And he's kneeling in a way that suggests in the opening up of his life that I'm bearing myself and my need to you. I'm disclosing what it is that I really want you to do. And if you were to zoom in on this painting, you would see the Romans behind the centurion kind of looking at each other almost as though, what is our boss doing kneeling in front of a Jew? They're supposed to be the ones to kneel and kiss our sandals. What is happening? And there are even looks on the faces, and it seems to be discussion going on in Jesus and among Jesus' disciples in the left-hand part of the image, dismayed, looking at one another. What could this mean, that this man, with all of his authority, representing the power of Rome, is kneeling before our rabbi, and now our rabbi is telling us that we should be more like him? And then in the backdrop, all the people who are the audience come to listen and to see the things that Jesus will do once again are observing it. My question is, why does Jesus choose to answer this man's prayer? I don't know if you think about it this way, but this centurion had several good personal reasons not to approach Jesus. He had the power instead to summon Jesus, to send his entourage, his representatives, go find that miracle-performing rabbi and bring him to me, as though he's summoning someone to patch a leaky part of his roof. But he doesn't do that. He goes out to find Jesus personally and publicly. And he's not a Jew. He's a Gentile from Rome, which means as a Roman soldier, the basic framework of his relationship with Jesus is of military conqueror and subject. And further, there's been nothing that this man has done in this story in the Gospel of Matthew that is noteworthy in terms of his religious qualifications. Nothing at all. He just shows up and makes a great request. It took a lot of courage for this Roman centurion to approach Jesus publicly and make this request. And he begins his request with, Lord, recognizing immediately that Jesus is also a person of authority. And when he makes his description of, Lord, my servant is at home paralyzed and suffering terribly, this tells me that he's making a request that is within the will of God. You see, he didn't approach Jesus and say, hey, rabbi, teacher, soothsayer, magician, my work productivity has been greatly impacted because I've got somebody sick, and I've got a lot of responsibility, many things to accomplish. If you could fix that for me so that I can get back to doing that which I've been charged to do, I would really be grateful. That's not his motivation. He speaks out of the suffering he's observing in his servant. His heart is moved for the suffering of his servant. And he brings that to Jesus to ask for Jesus to intervene, not for personal benefit, it seems, but for the restoration of the health of the servant. Jesus honors that because Jesus feels the same way towards suffering people. This prayer request is clearly within the will of God because you see similar emotional reaction from Jesus to those who are suffering as you see this man towards his servant. And he says to Jesus, if you're going to bring about this miracle, it's going to be because of your willingness and power, not necessarily my religious fitness. What do I mean by that? When Jesus requires him to be specific, what are you asking for me to do? You hear this expression of humility and confidence in Jesus. Humility in himself, confidence in Jesus. And so he says, Lord, I don't deserve to have you even come to my house. He must have known that for Jesus, a devout Jew, to enter under the roof of a Gentile was a ceremonial breaking of a law. Jesus wasn't supposed to do that. He would have been considered impure himself. And he says, instead, if you'll just speak the word, I know that my servant can be healed. Now think about this. He says, I'm a man under authority. I have absolute authority and command. When I say jump, all of those under my command say how high. And in this graphic, he's essentially saying it, put another way, I have a circle. And when one of the soldiers who is required to serve under my leadership is given an instruction, they don't get to ignore it. They don't get to argue with me. It's not a bartering, teamwork, collaborative process. I say it and it's done. But my circle is limited. And I know you have a circle, Jesus. And within your circle, it's not contained by geography. It's not limited to a certain number of people. The entirety of the world is under your authority. And I recognize that. And the reason I am asking you to heal my servant from here rather than there is because I know you have the power to do it. And Jesus uses a word to describe how he's amazed. That's his reaction. Thaumazo, to wonder at, to marvel, to admire. This is the only time in Matthew's gospel, it's used a total of 8 times, that word amazed. It is the only time in Matthew's gospel that is used to describe Jesus' response to a person. Every other time, it is other people reacting to a miracle or a teaching or a statement by Jesus. And Jesus is just, wow. He gets it. And get this. This act of courage at the risk of embarrassment and public ridicule and frankly, maybe even insubordination by those soldiers under his command, the centurion coming and kneeling before Jesus, calling him Lord, asking for his help, that in itself brings glory to Jesus for all those who are witnessing it. All of those apprentices, everyone in the town, the people up on the terrace in the background of the image, and all of us in 2025 in Hoover, Alabama. Jesus is brought glory by this request made in the way that it is. Friends, here's what I would encourage you to think about and consider with this story. Sometimes you and I fail to pray prayers that need to be prayed because we feel unworthy and inadequate, thinking that maybe the prayer would best come from someone else. You don't pray the shamelessly audacious prayer, God, it's going to take a resurrection miracle to put my marriage back together. And I don't pray that, God. I don't feel like I can ask God to fix it, to perform that miracle, to restore that relationship, because I know what a jerk I was. I know that I was. I didn't fulfill my vows. I didn't live into the covenant the way that I should have lived into the covenant. So I can't pray that. God knows that it's mostly my fault. We don't pray, God, my child is spiritually lost, and I am concerned about them, and I'm asking you to bring them back into your fold. We don't do that because we sheepishly recognize that maybe we could have done a better job at home as a Christian example for our kids, or involving them in the life of God's church. And so we're hesitant to name that before God as though God would turn right back and say, well, you know, if you'd done better in the first place. We don't pray for the person who is physically in need of healing, a divine touch, more than what a doctor, more than what a treatment, a medicine, a procedure, a surgery could bring. We don't do that because we think that's the kind of prayer that really holy people can pray for, but not me. I barely have enough quality of faith to identify as a Christian myself. I can't ask God for something that big and that audacious. There is a natural human temptation to filter our prayers through ourselves and our own projected quality of our own faith rather than solely in the power and the presence of God. We feel unworthy or hesitant, and that is a fundamental error in our thinking and in our faith, according to this story, because this man had no qualifications at all other than desperation and recognition and kneeling and saying, Lord. I was thinking this week about when I went, it's been so cold, and I went to Washington, D.C. It was the coldest I've ever been in my life. It was in the spring, or I guess January of 2003. I was a junior in college, and I was there for a class in government. We went and spent 5 days, and we got to visit the Capitol and meet with politicians and the chaplain of the Senate and all these different figures. It was really, really a great experience. Our first night there, we made it there. We flew in, and then we decided to do a nighttime tour of the monuments. So we went to the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial and the Jefferson Memorial and so on. And as we went around the tidal basin, which is depicted here, some of you have been to where they have the cherry blossoms in just a couple of months will all just be exploding. Beautiful. We were visiting Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. It's right next to the water. And our group of about 8 or 10 with our professor, Dr. Brett Fulton, we kind of went down to the water, and I realized, I mean, it was 10 degrees with a wind chill, pushed it down to zero. We were freezing. And I realized the tidal basin was frozen. It had been cold for days. It was frozen. And it didn't look like the ponds that I've used to, you know, thin layer of glass, quarter of an inch thick at the most here in the South when it freezes. No, it looked thick. And I decided to be a college junior and decide I was going to try to step out on that ice. Now, this is not a tragedy. I put my foot down on the edge, kept my hands on the edge of the kind of barrier wall that you can see there to the right, and started to put my weight down. I tapped my foot just a little bit, and a couple of my you know, fellow students were like, man, you're crazy. Like, I would not step out there like that. I was like, no. I said, no, I think it's okay. I think it's strong enough. And Dr. Fulton just kind of grinned and said, I'm not sure your opinion about the ice is what's most important here. And I held the hand of one of my fellow students, and I slowly just kind of stood up just for a second. I said, all right, let go. Now get back. And I called him. The metaphor I'm offering you. I could feel very, very confident about stepping out on thin ice and fall through and die in the freezing waters of the Potomac tidal basin. Or I could feel really anxious, not an expert, really hesitant to step out on really thick ice and be totally safe. What's more important? How I feel about the ice or the actual strength of that which is supposed to be supporting me? It is not the quality of our faith that makes the difference.
It is the object of our faith that makes the difference. That's where the power is in the story. You don't need to focus on the eloquence of your words before Jesus. You don't need to feel limited by your religious qualifications. You don't need to feel hesitant because your prayer is just too embarrassingly big. You just need to say, Lord, within your will, for your glory, this is it. And there's no reason why you should do this based on the quality of my faith. I just know that you are the kind of God who has the power and the kindness, and I'm asking. My encouragement to you, friends, is to pray a prayer during these 40 days with shameless audacity. Yes, within the will of God. Yes, for the glory of God. And then I am believing that at the end of these 40 days, there are going to be some stories that begin to pop up in this church because people, maybe for the first time in their life, tried that. Do you know who the first person is when Jesus dies upon the cross and entrusts his soul into the hands of his heavenly Father? There, for the second time in Matthew's gospel, is a centurion who looks up at him and says, this man was the Son of God. I don't think he said that because of his own condition of faith. It's a recognition of the power and authority in that person. God, we want to be a people that follow your instruction and the example of this centurion to pray prayers of shameless audacity. We need courage to pray prayers like that. We need to be willing to feel embarrassed in front of others because we have the gumption to pray a prayer that is so audacious. But Lord, help us to be a people of faith, not to just evaluate the quality or the depth of our own faith, but simply a faith that is focused on the object, your Son Jesus, and to trust that within His will and for His glory, He will move. We pray this in His name. Amen.
The Church at Rossbridge is located in Birmingham, Alabama, and helps people find abundant life in Jesus Christ.